From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, near-death experiences in children, an incredible program with Dr. Melvin Morse. Iran has test-fired a missile capable of striking Israel, U.S. Mideast bases in Europe on a show of strength touted by President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad as he battles for re-election next month against more moderate opponents. The U.S. responded by saying Iran must choose between destabilizing the Middle East or accepting the dialogue offered by President Barack Obama. The U.S. leader threatened earlier this week that Iran could face further international sanctions if it does not respond positively by year-end to U.S. attempts to open negotiations on its nuclear program. Israel said the test appeared to be Iran's response to a positive meeting on Monday between President Obama and new Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Jerry Corsi, who follows the Iranian situation quite closely, on the line with us now. Jerry, what do you think of this missile test?
Well, George, it's clearly provocative. I think what Iran is trying to say by firing this missile just 2 days after President Obama met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is that Iran has no intention whatsoever of making concessions in its attempt to enrich uranium, its missile program, and ultimately its attempt to develop nuclear weapons. So it's a very direct, in-your-face statement to President Obama not to expect major concessions from Iran.
Jerry, there are a number of people, including myself, who believe that Israel may be waiting for this election in June before taking any action. We talked about this last month. What's your take now?
I agree with you, George. I think that Israel will wait until after the Iranian election to see who is the victor. If Ahmadinejad wins, it'll be a clear indication that Iran intends to pursue this aggressive course against Israel. Ahmadinejad has repeatedly said he wants to wipe Israel from the face of the Middle East. And so I think that the two events that have to have occurred, one has occurred, and that is Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, has now met with President Obama, and I think the results were disappointing for Israel, that the United States is not going to stand with Israel unconditionally, but instead is going to press for the creation of a Palestinian state and direct talks with Iran. The second event will come after the Iranian election in June, and I think when that's over, Israel will have the information they need to know whether or not it's likely that sanctions or other attempts to persuade Iran to stop nuclear enrichment have any chance of success.
Jerry Corsi, of course, writes for WorldNet Daily, also a number of books. He's an expert on the Iranian situation. Jerry, you take care of yourself and be safe with everything you do. In New Ulm, Minnesota, the father of a 13-year-old cancer-stricken boy who ran off with his mother to avoid court-ordered chemotherapy treatment is asking the two to come home. Colleen Hauser and her son Daniel, who has Hodgkin's lymphoma, apparently left their southern Minnesota home sometime after a Monday's doctor's appointment and an x-ray that showed his tumor had grown. Doctors say the chemotherapy is needed to save the boy's life. A new strain of MRSA seems to be triggering a deadly form of pneumonia in people who catch flu. Researchers believe the new strain of the antibiotic-resistant bacterium is becoming more widespread now. It is known as community-acquired MRSA because, unlike most forms of the superbug, it poses a significant risk outside of hospitals. In Australia, a doctor in rural Australia used a handyman's power drill to bore a hole into the skull of a boy with a severe head injury, saving the boy's life. Nicholas Rossi fell off his bike, hitting his head on the pavement. He was not wearing a helmet. When he got home, Nicholas complained of a headache, and his mother, Karen, a nurse, took him to the hospital. At the hospital, Dr. Rob Carson realized the boy was suffering bleeding on the brain, which can be fatal, and he knew he had to make a hole in the boy's skull to relieve the pressure. But the small hospital was not equipped with a neurological drill, so Carson sent for a household drill from the maintenance room. Carson drilled until a blood clot fell out and continued to treat Nicholas until he could be airlifted an hour later to a children's hospital. He left the hospital on Tuesday, the day of his 13th birthday. A fiercely debated, long-delayed investigation into Ireland's Roman Catholic-run institutions says priests and nuns terrorized thousands of boys and girls in a workhouse-style schools for decades, and the government inspectors failed to stop the chronic beatings, rapes, and humiliations. 9 years in the making, the 2,600-page report sides almost completely with the horrific reports of abuse from former students sent to more than 250 church-run, mostly residential institutions. It concluded that church officials always shielded their pedophiles from arrest to protect their own reputations, and according to documents uncovered in the Vatican, knew that many pedophiles were serial attackers. Congress has sent President Barack Obama a bill with sweeping new rules for the credit card industry that will affect just about everyone. The new restrictions will protect debt-ridden consumers from many of the surprise charges common in the industry, like over-the-limit fees and a charge to pay the phone by bill. People under 21 will also find it difficult to get a card, and they attach something interesting to this bill to allow you to carry a concealed weapon inside national parks. We're going to talk about guns in a moment, by the way. In England, a dog dialed 999. That's the equivalent of 911 here. Police feared the worst when they received this 999 call, which sounded as if a serious attack was underway. Operatives heard whining noises and a man shouting, "Come out or else, I'm warning you." Then the line went dead. Fearing the worst, police rang back, but it turned out to be a shaggy dog story. A very apologetic woman confirmed all was well and that the culprit was her pet dog, Bailey. You see, the 14-month-old golden retriever had somehow grabbed the house phone in his mouth and ran off into the garden. The emergency call operator had heard the woman's husband trying to get the dog to come out from his hiding place behind the garden shed. As I mentioned, we're talking about guns this hour. Utah lawmakers are considering following Montana's lead and claiming states' rights in the war over gun control. The Montana legislature passed, and its governor signed into law, a measure making guns that are made and kept within state boundaries exempt from federal regulations. Now, that means they're exempt from things like background checks, licensing, and registration. Several Utah lawmakers want to do the same thing, and they say President Barack Obama and Congress are anti-gun and will infringe on states' rights. In a moment, we'll talk with a state representative from Montana who sponsored the legislation, and also John Lott. More guns, less crime. In just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Joel Bonnick, a state representative from Livingston area of Montana, sponsored legislation exempting Montana-made guns from federal legislation. The bill was signed into law April 15th of this year. I've got two guests for you. First of all, Joel. Joel, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much.
Great. Appreciate you being on the program. And of course, John Lott, regular here on Coast to Coast, senior research scientist at the University of Maryland, was the chief economist at the United States Sentencing Commission during 88 and 89. He has authored a number of books, including More Guns, Less Crime, The Bias Against Guns as well. Here he is back on Coast to Coast. John Lott. Hi, John.
Great to talk to you again, George.
Likewise. Let's start with you, Joel. Tell me about the legislation and what got you to sponsor it.
Well, it's good legislation, and I'm a first-term legislator, and so I was contacted by the Montana Shooting Sports Association, even as a candidate, to see where I stood on certain issues, and they have a list of what they call good legislation that they try to pass. And over the years, they've been instrumental in getting a lot of good legislation through the Montana State Legislature, which makes us one of the best places to own and keep firearms. And when I was elected, they approached me to carry this bill, and which I was happy to do because I'm interested in constitutional government and freedom for all people in Montana and the United States. And I could see that this would certainly be a step forward.
John Lott, give me your reaction to this legislation.
Well, I mean, I think it's a great idea. I hope the courts will agree with what Joel's done here. I mean, it's amazing that a first-time legislator can go and get the type of national attention and to get people to focus on this. The problem I think you're going to have is that there's been so much, many court decisions that have been built up since the Great Depression that run against this. You have decisions where saying that, let me back up. You look at the Constitution, and it gives the power of the federal government to regulate commerce among the states, between the states. It doesn't give it the power to regulate commerce within each state.
Within the state, exactly.
Right. But what's happened is when we've had all the regulatory apparatus that arose under the New Deal, is the court essentially said anything you do can affect interstate trade. So you look at the very first decision. There's the case by Wickard v. Filburn in 1942. The federal government had said each farmer is allowed to raise only so much wheat. And if you do more than that, we're going to put penalties on you because it's going to make too much wheat out there and it's going to lower the price of wheat and the government wants to prop up the price of wheat. Well, there's a farmer who said, look, I don't sell any wheat. I only raise wheat only for my own use, and therefore the government regulation doesn't apply because I'm not even selling it across state boundaries. It stays in my farm, all this wheat. But the federal government said, and the Supreme Court agreed, that whether the fact that he's not buying wheat anymore because he's growing it himself affects interstate commerce, and therefore the federal government can still regulate the amount of wheat that he has. And so, I mean, it's nuts. I mean, it's obviously something that's against what the founders intended, or they wouldn't even have bothered putting in the Commerce Clause to begin with in the Constitution. But if Joel wins, and I hope he does, there's so many federal regulations which are going to be challenged then. And I think in part because of the fear of that, it's going to be difficult sledding on it. And I think, you know, if he had any chance, there was a case that was somewhat analogous, a Lopez decision that came down that challenged the Safe School Zone Act about a decade ago.
Right.
And it was a 5-4 decision. But you would pretty much have most of the same players on the Supreme Court. You know, hopefully Alito and Roberts would still make the same decision that their predecessors had made. But it was a 5-4 decision. But the problem is you're not going to get into any better position as far as the court goes for the next 4 years at least. And I, you know, you're going to have a change in president, I think, for him to win at the Supreme Court on this.
Okay, assuming this law, Joel, stands, okay, it gets challenged in the court, but you're victorious in Montana. Making guns that are made and kept within the state boundaries are exempt from federal regulations, which means then no background checks, licensing, registration. Are there any guns made in the state of Montana now? Because most of the big manufacturers, I don't believe, are there. I could be wrong.
Yeah, there are many guns made in Montana. Most of them are fairly small companies, but they have a national market and even greater than that. But, you know, the main point is here is not just to build firearms, it's to assert states' rights. And I agree with John that this is an uphill battle. But let me tell you what's happening here. You know, there are other states that are getting on board with this whole concept of state sovereignty, and they're pushing it forward. And this is a good way to push it forward because, unlike medical marijuana, which was a recent Supreme Court case, which could not be distinguished from interstate or intrastate commerce, made in Montana guns can be distinguished because they can be designated made in Montana and stay in Montana. And so we do have some greater leverage there. See, what we're trying to do here is get people to think about constitutional terms and also governments. And what we'd like to see happen is that the states of America would rein in the creature that they have created, which is the federal government. See, we have this idea, mistakenly, that the federal government is sovereign over the states, and it's not that way. It is the other way around. And so if we can get all the states to come on board with this kind of legislation, then we can have a pushback against the federal government. Because everybody realizes here in the United States that the federal government is overreaching its authority. When the Constitution says that Congress can regulate commerce between the states, they understood in that in that time the word regulate meant to make regular. And we think of it now as to put all kinds of burdensome regulations on the states, and that's not it. And so people understand that if you make commerce regular, that means fair trade. It does not mean that Congress can restrict everything that you do.
All right, John Lott, yeah, you know I support guns, and I also support the concealed weapons for individuals. What's wrong with background checks and some licensing and registration?
John Lott? I have nothing intrinsically against background checks. I guess the thing is, though, there have been a lot of academics who have looked at this, a lot of studies, and there's no one that's found that any of these laws have reduced crime. You know, the point is that criminals go and get guns from so many different sources.
True.
And, you know, my thought has been is it makes people feel a lot better to go and have background checks. Fine. I don't think they do really much harm. The only time that they really have done much harm is when during the Clinton administration, the computer system regularly broke down. You had it for the last year of the Clinton administration. The computerized background check system was down an average of 6.5 days a month.
See, I guess the problem, though, John, the big problem with that is people are so disappointed in government, and nobody knows what future government will be like.
Right.
I think they're concerned that, you know, they're going to have everybody's names and addresses of gun owners, and they're going to know where to go and get those guns.
No, I mean, I think you're exactly right. And, you know, in some sense, we already have a registration system. The gun dealers have to keep the records. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms can find out who they've sold all their guns to. And, you know, as you look at countries around the world, whether it be Britain or Canada or even in California, when guns have been decided to be illegal at a later date, governments have used those lists of gun owners to go and make sure they know who has to go and turn in their gun. So often we're told when we have some type of registration system that, well, we're never going to take your guns away. And yet time after time around the world, we find that, in fact, that's what those lists end up being used for.
Joel, what was the vote for this legislation? Did it pass by an easy margin, or was it tight?
Well, it started out with just a simple majority, about the 64-35 in the House. But on third reading, we got it to 80-20 in a 100 representative body.
God, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's good. You know, John's certainly right that licensing, you know, is really the authority to deny. And the problem that we see historically is that licensing leads to registration, and registration leads to confiscation. And there's never been a genocide in the history of the world recently that has not been preceded by gun confiscation. And, you know, I'm getting responses from people all across this country. And when you threaten their firearms ownership, they're very defensive about that because they realize that without the ability to own firearms, you're no more than a slave.
Well, absolutely. And I think that's the big problem, the potential of confiscation and knowing who has what. You know, the government, if they decide to confiscate one day, they're not going to be able to find it from the criminals, John Lott, because they don't know who they are.
Right. I mean, that's the basic problem with gun control, and that is who's most likely to obey these laws. And what we find time after time, it's the law-abiding good citizens who obey them and not the criminals. And the problem that you face is that if you pass these laws, no matter how well-meaning, and they tend to disarm law-abiding citizens relative to criminals, you can see increases in violent crime rates rather than drops. And, you know, we have so many laws that are on the books, and it's just every one of them just makes it a little bit more costly, some a lot more costly, for law-abiding citizens to go and own guns.
Joel, to date, is the federal government now going after this law in Montana?
You know, George, it doesn't take effect until October 1st of this year.
Okay.
So there's been no official response. And, you know, this is a little bit like a chess game, and we've made our move, and it'll remain to be seen what's going to happen with them. But our next step here is to get what we call a squeaky clean manufacturer to register his intent to manufacture, let's say, a simple bolt-action youth model 22 rifle, and then see what the feds do. What we're trying to avoid with this whole scenario is that someone would actually start manufacturing firearms and then come under felony penalties to get standing in court. We want to get standing in court without subjecting an innocent citizen to that kind of jeopardy.
Well, good luck with this, Joel. I know people in Montana are just standing up for joy that this has passed.
And, you know, not just in Montana, but I'm getting calls from all
It's growing.
States. There's at least a dozen states that are working on it right now. And every week I'm getting more calls from other legislators saying, you know, we need to do this in our state. And, you know, that's just what we want, because this needs to go to every state in the union, because the state that created the federal government, and they are the only ones that can rein it in.
We'll be back in a moment with phone calls as we talk about this gun law and gun issues right here on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, Dr. Melvin Morris joins us as we talk about his work into near-death experiences as it directly relates to children, and also some of his mind-body healing work. Should be a fascinating program. When we come right back, we'll take your phone calls with John Lott, More Guns, Less Crime, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, back with John Lott and your phone calls. John, that's a pretty dramatic law that they passed in Montana. Pretty gutsy on their part, don't you think?
Oh, no, I agree. I think even the fact that they're raising this issue deserves a lot of praise, but... You know, the fact that Joel was able to get 80% of the state house there to go along with him is nothing short of miraculous.
Yeah, that is pretty dramatic. To Steve we go in Chicago. You're up with us east of the Rockies. Steven, go ahead.
Hi, thanks, George. I'm a big fan of the show.
Sure, thank you.
It's been a while. It's been a long 7 months. I haven't been able to listen to it till now. I just got out of prison for possession of a handgun. My case was, I was coming, you know, I'm in Minnesota. I got a family. I went back to Indiana to visit my family, like my father and such. So I took my handgun to be safe, to keep it out of the house, away from the kids.
Sure. And you legally owned it, right?
Yeah, legally owned it. But okay. I didn't have any kind of firearms owner identification. Now, when I was coming back from Indiana, I got pulled over. And it was in a traffic jam. I removed my seatbelt. He wanted to search my car. So to be completely fair and honest and safe, I told him that I had it.
You okay. Know, and that's smart. That's
yeah,
smart.
You know, being honest. And, well, he found it. It was in a gun. It was in the box underneath another box. But the box it was in had a whole bunch of stuff on top of it and everything. But I did 4 months in the county here, and then I ended up doing 61 days in prison. Now I'm on parole. And I'm not supposed to leave this state for a whole year.
What?
Yeah. And I'm not even from here. I got a child and, you know, girlfriend, house, job. I go to school and everything in Minnesota. So it's ridiculous. I'm actually staying in a motel, a cheap motel.
Oh, my God. So were you able ever to prove that you had a agreement to buy this, that you had a purchase agreement?
Yeah, they said that I could go to trial with all that, and my father was the one who actually gave me, you know, the gun. So
right.
You know, he knew that my plans were to go work part-time security up in Minnesota. So, you know, I, of course, you know, he gave me some ammunition and all kinds of stuff like that. He knows of, I had a permit when I was 18 years old. I'm 29 now. And he knew, you know, the situation. He knew I was going straight home, no ifs, ands, or buts. But they said I could fight it, but...
Where were you picked up? Where did you get into trouble with this?
Indiana.
Chicago.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess the question I have is you're allowed to have interstate transportation of guns. I mean, if you're heading home, it's not clear to me on what grounds and you're not a resident of Indiana. On what grounds that they could have, and you didn't have ready access to the gun. I mean, that's
it was in a box.
Yeah, right. This was Chicago where I got pulled over.
Oh, Chicago. Okay.
But see, that's the reason why I was asking, because you're allowed. I mean, you can drive through Washington D.C. with a gun as long as you're not stopping there. You know, because that would interfere with interstate trade if they just said you can't transfer a gun. Now, I assume the gun was loaded?
Yes.
Right. Well, I mean, that Illinois might make a little bit of a deal about that, but the fact that it wasn't accessible, was it in the trunk?
It was in a Suburban, Chevy Suburban, all the way in the back, in a box right. Underneath another box full of stuff.
Yeah, there is no trunk. It's just all one car.
Right. Yeah. Well, I would say you need a better lawyer.
I would have fought that. You too, John?
You're allowed to transport a gun in interstate trade, you know, and different states will say you can't have ready access to a gun, but it sounds like you could have, even though you don't have a trunk, it sounds like you could have made ready, you could have made a strong case that you didn't, there's no ready access that you had to it.
In Illinois, you've got to have the gun and the clip in two separate places, and far enough away where you can't reach it while you're driving. Well, in this case, you couldn't reach your gun, but the clip was in the gun.
Right.
But still, John, what if, aren't you supposed to carry your purchase invoice or some purchase agreement with you that shows that you're the owner of the gun if you're in a different state?
No, there's no requirement like
nothing
that.
And like
I understand that he mentioned the FOID card. I believe that that's what you're referring to. That's required in Illinois, but that's for Illinois residents. And if you're traveling through the state, now you weren't, were you stopping to visit people in Illinois? Were you spending time there at all? You were just driving through to get back to Minnesota, right?
Never planned on stopping at all.
Right. I mean, it's, I don't know. If the case is as you describe it, you should have gotten a better lawyer.
I think he should have fought it. And Steve, maybe you should still at least try to get that off your record. Let's move on to a couple other callers. Man, that's an incredible story. Port Chester, New York. Mark, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Mark, good morning.
Oh, outstanding. George, my heart's pounding. My head's going to explode. I talked to you once before with Alex Jones about this issue months ago. I love your show. I love everybody. Ian Punnett. Mr. Lott, I have both your books, Bias Against Guns and More Guns, Less Crime. I am a devotee to you, sir. I'm a member of practically every gun organization in this country. But let me just make a couple of points. John, you know, politicians like Bloomberg, Deval Patrick, I have legislators here in Westchester County. They use this incrementalism. They don't take everything right away, but they make restrictions on restrictions on restrictions. I can only speak for myself, but trust me, George and John, I've had conversations with friends and coworkers. We're sick and tired of this. You know, John, we're the most law-abiding people in this country. We have permits, and in New York, everything's registered, fingerprints, facial recognition, photographs, and still they don't let us carry. All we want to do is to be left alone and be able to protect ourselves in a life-and-death situation. Some of us, including myself, have taken extensive training, armed security guard courses, just because we want to be left alone, but productive members of society. We're not out to hurt anybody, and we're tired. We're tired of being pinched. They use incrementalism. They pit handgun owners and hunters and long gun and 50 caliber right against each other. Their registration for ammo now, it's just, it's absolutely sick. And I don't understand why these politicians that pass these laws that have armed bodyguards, they're never held responsible. No one ever says, hey, Bloomberg or someone else, you know, now you got a rapist running out the Upper East Side every 6 months. No one can defend themselves, and they're never held responsible for the laws that they enact to restrict us people. And let's take a clause, if I could, John, from the homosexuals. They want to use the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution to recognize gay marriages all over the country. Well, hell, why don't you recognize my gun license? That poor fellow in Chicago, he was trying to do the right thing, and he got locked up. In New York, and you have district attorneys of Albany, and you have in New Jersey, you fly into Newark, they'll lock you up if you have the gun, if you're transferring planes. But under the Federal Firearm Owners Protection Act, FOPA, passed under Ronald Reagan, they're not supposed to give you this kind of grief. But I say, since we jumped through all these hoops, leave us the hell alone. And I could go on and on. Thank you, George. God bless you. I'll call you in a few months.
I appreciate your emotions there, and I understand what you're saying. Just the first point about how these things change gradually. New York is a perfect example. They have the registration and licensing of the handguns there, and now they have higher fees. You know, so like they put the system in, they say, oh, it's only going to be $5 fee or $10, and then over time you see them increasing it to hundreds of dollars. You know, there's no way they don't understand that that's just going to make it difficult for the law-abiding citizens who've gone through the process to be able to go and have guns. You make it so that people have to wait 6 months in New York City to get through any type of registration process that they have there, and it can often drag out much longer than that. You know, just little things where it was sold as one particular type of regulation, and then these things morph, just like we were talking about before with the registration. They promised people up and down that, look, we're just using this to go and solve crimes. And then it turns into something where they go and take the guns from law-abiding citizens around the world. And, you know, there's so little discussion or debate about whether these rules actually accomplish what they're claimed to accomplish to begin with. You know, with all the rules that you have in New York, I think it's, you know, the registration licensing that they have there in the state. I've gone through this. I've talked to police around the country where you have registration licensing, and they can't point to cases where they've actually been able to solve crimes as a result of those types of laws. Laws that, as you're saying, impose real costs on law-abiding citizens.
There's a place in St. Louis called Bullseye that I go and target practice every once in a while, John, and it's run by some good people, including some former police officers. Right. And they have contracts with the police departments, too, because a lot of the guys and women are there shooting, practicing. And I've got to tell you, they universally support the right of citizens to be able to carry weapons. It's their bosses, the police chiefs, who don't, and the politicians.
Right. No, you're exactly right. You see polls overwhelmingly show street officers. Street officers, my research has convinced me that police are the single most important factor for reducing crime. But even though the police understand that, they also realize the limitations. They also realize that they can't be there all the time, that they arrive on the crime scenes after the crime's been committed. And they know the benefit that they get from having guns. They know the problems that they face with criminals all the time. And so they're very sympathetic. They understand these things firsthand in terms of the costs and benefits. And so you look at surveys, you'll find surveys where 95% of police think Americans have a right to own a gun for their personal protection. You'll find not quite as high, but percentages in the high 70s, which will show rank-and-file street officers support people being able to carry permitted concealed handguns. And you know, it's because they see firsthand what can happen to people if they can't protect themselves.
Let's go to Las Vegas. Richard, it's you. Hi, Richard.
Hi, George. Happy pre-birthday to you.
It's coming up, isn't it?
It's coming up quick. Mine's the 25th.
Me too.
Yeah. I appreciate this effort. I don't take stands on either side. My only concern, I mean, at one point on Whitsitt there in North Hollywood, right on a bridge, I was caught in a crossfire of a car they stopped with four people in it. There were LA's finest all around, and yet they almost shot at each other. Thank God nobody in the car had a weapon. So my concern is, and I have another thing here. My concern is that these people, how do we know who's really capable of carrying a gun? I mean, like I remember Dirty Harry, you know, with the targets that mm-hmm. would pop up. And if people should have to go through one of those before having a weapon, I would certainly feel safer. I would look at every person as though they carried a weapon, having years of martial arts behind me. If things passed in the country, I would look at it that way. And people who are worried about states' rights against the federal government, well, I have a friend who was a lieutenant colonel during the Watts riots, and I remember going home one night, and there were thousands of troops in trucks in a parking lot not far from where I lived, and they just stayed there waiting in the valley. And they had nuclear-tipped bullets, and if anybody got out of hand, they were prepared to go in there and finish the job. So I don't see where, you know, I think people are going to have a big problem with the federal government and with plain citizens like me who are just concerned with what if a situation pops up. And, you know, these situations could pop up anywhere. You need sometimes instant reaction time. And will these people sure. do the right thing?
Well, we know, John, that for concealed weapons permits, everybody needs to go through a pretty stringent course, correct?
Well, it depends on the state, but half the states require some type of training, but half of them don't. I mean, you have some states like Texas, which will require up to 10 hours of training, but Pennsylvania, Indiana are states, for example, that don't require training. But the thing is, the proof's in the pudding, though. We have 5 million Americans right now that have active concealed handgun permits. We have extremely detailed data on how they behave, whether they've done anything wrong. You know, my guess is even when you don't require the training in terms of a formal class, people are careful. They're law-abiding citizens. They have a lot to lose if they go and do something wrong. And what you find is that these people lose their permits for any reason, any gun-related violation, at hundreds or thousands of one percentage point. And even that tiny amount, usually it was very trivial type of violation. Primarily something like people accidentally carrying a gun into a gun-free zone, like a college campus or a school or an airport, and something that they didn't even do intentionally. And so, the amazing thing to me, when I go through these stories of civilians stopping multiple victim public shootings or other types of attacks, is how rarely they even have to fire the gun. The very fact that they're there able to brandish a gun causes criminals to leave. Criminals like to go after victims that are easy prey. When I was chief economist at the United States Sentencing Commission, I must have read thousands of court cases where you'd have two burglars or two robbers. One would turn evidence against another. The prosecutors would ask the same questions over and over again. You know, why did you choose this particular victim to go after? And they would say things like, well, you know, we knew the drug dealer had a lot of money down the street, but, you know, he would have guns and he'd be really tough to go after. We thought about going after a cab driver, but a lot of them are armed. And then we saw this kind of meek-looking guy walking across, or a woman walking across a parking lot late at night by themselves, and they looked easy to go after. And so, you know, you make something more difficult, something more costly for these criminals to do, they do less of it. And the fact that these citizens, they only fire their guns when they absolutely have to, because they know they have a lot to lose if they go and behave improperly with these things.
So Montana has passed. Utah's looking at it. How many other states?
Well, Texas is considering it. Texas, just today, the state Senate passed another gun law on letting people carry permanent concealed handguns on college campuses. But I think, you know, as Joel was saying, I think you have 12 states altogether that are considering the type of law that was passed in Montana. At least it's going to get people talking about the issue.
Absolutely. I think we have time to squeeze in. You, Wayne, from L.A. Real quickly, Wayne, go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. How you doing?
Good.
Fine,
thanks. I'm a former Marine. I've been a licensed private investigator in the business for 40 years, former federal agent in between there for a number of years. And my weapons trainer qualifies me 3 times a year, and on every second year I get certified, so I maintain my exposed weapons permit by the state of California. But yet the state of California, for my weapons trainer as well as me, refuses to give us CCWs.
Right.
Because we are not considered qualified by any sheriff or chief of police in the counties that we are residing and doing business in.
And some of these sheriff departments are very, very tough, John Lott. They control these things very closely. John Lott, our guest, thanks, John, for being on the program. That concludes this hour. When I come right back on Coast to Coast AM, Dr. Melvin Morris joins us as we talk about near-death experiences, young children, and also mind-body healing.